You know, Bev, I'm really tired. I could use a pick-me-up.
Have you heard of Spark Plug Coffee?
What is that?
Well, rejoice, Ryan, and fellow Canadians. No longer are you beholden to the selection offered by your grocery store or forced to make special trips to your local hipster Java joint. Spark Plug Coffee offers delivery all over Canada of freshly roasted, high-quality beans right to your door. Spark Plug custom roasts your beans to order so that it's always fresh and consistently delicious.
And how do I acquire this product?
Just go to their website, sparkplugcoffee.com, to get started.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Willkommen, Fräulein, and Dankeschön. Oh, darling, Dankeschön. For hitting that button to hear the Top 100 Project as we count down the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the 123 greatest American movies. Note, spoilage is coming. I am your master of ceremonies, Ryan Ellis, with that nightclub sensation, my wife Bev.
That's me.
That is you. The coming attractions trivia for our final musical on this list, Cabaret. Which member of the Minnelli family had the most American Film Institute films? Liza, her father Vincent, or her mother, Judy Garland?
I think it was Vincent.
How many did he have then?
That's a good question. I'm going to let you field that one.
It's one of my patented trick questions. They only had one each.
Oh, really? What was Minnelli's again?
Liza's is this, of course. We'll get to her very soon. Vincent Minnelli's is one of your favorites, An American in Paris. He directed better films that didn't make this list, including The Bad and the Beautiful, which we've talked about plenty of times. And Judy Garland, we all know she was in the classic Wizard of Oz. So they all made other films. Well, at least the parents made other films that could have made this list, including Meet Me in St. Louis, which Vincent directed and Judy was in.
Yeah, which makes a lot of people's best musicals of all time.
And it's also on several other AFI lists that are not the top 100. But one each. Okay, so movie number 84 on the top 100 project, Cabaret, was not on AFI's 1998 top 100, but it was one of the 400 nominees. Then it ranked all the way up in 63rd place in 2007 between American Graffiti and Network. Allied Artists, that's the first time we've mentioned them, released Cabaret on February 13th, 1972, only 2 years and 1 day before I was born. Useless trivia for you right there. The movie was a crowd pleaser and people flocked to see it. And Bev's going to describe Cabaret for you now with the skinny.
Liza Minnelli is Sally Bowles, an American nightclub performer working at a burlesque joint in pre-World War II Berlin. She meets Michael York's Brian Roberts, a British writer new to Germany. The two begin a romance of sorts, and through it all, Minnelli and Joel Grey rock the house at the nightclub.
Or in a nutshell, the rise of the Nazis with jazz hands. Jazz hands, which are not in this movie, but that's a Judy Garland specialty. So I thought it would be fun to say that. So anyway, 97% of Rotten Tomatoes critics, 33 fresh, only one rotten review. 87% of audiences. Also a pretty big hit that year. 8th at the 1972 U.S. box office. Number one was The Godfather. But what did Bev Ellis think of Cabaret?
So today we're going to record one of the rare Top 100 Project podcasts where you and I have a bona fide disagreement about the validity of a movie. And just like the last time, it was a musical, because I think the last time you and I really strongly disagreed on a movie, it was West Side Story. I feel like I'm far more confident defending Cabaret than West Side. I loved this movie. I think it's my second favorite musical after Singing in the Rain.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know where to go with that. All right, well.
Put your dukes up. Because you did not like this movie.
I can't quote myself because there's no swearing in this movie. But when the second show was on, and there it was, number 63, which is one of the higher ranking newcomers on the entire list. The highest ranked was what?
Oh, The General.
That's right. Number 18, which was a remarkably high ranking. Maybe a little bit too high for that, but 63 to me was a little too high for this one. And what I said was Cabba blank and Ray to myself as the commercial break happened. I thought, what in the world? Now seeing it again, many years later, I'd forgotten what it was even about. So I like it more. If we were two movie critics with a show, if we were Ellis and Ellis, I would say thumbs up, but I would not say 63rd or 99th or anything else AFI Top 100.
I actually think it was a great film, a masterpiece of a musical. One of the rare musicals you ever see that's this dark and cynical. It's just a pitch black comedy. It's not hilarious. Well, you laugh here and there, but it is a very dark, nihilistic film.
It's also different because every single performance, except for one, every single song anyway, except for one, is in the cabaret.
Yeah, they're all diegetic. They're all meant to be authentic, realistic. Not, you know, like Singing in the Rain, where everybody stops what they're doing and does a well-choreographed dance in the living room to a song they just made up on the spot. People aren't breaking into song without any motivation. I would compare the way they use music in this film to the way they use music in Easy Rider, where you pause the story and you have a song that's relevant to the theme while you look at something cool. You know, Easy Rider had those long traveling montages with the beautiful scenery and a song that, if you listen to it, was relevant to what was happening in the film. And this has the great dancing and the silly costumes and Joel Grey, oh my god, just him performing is so bloody watchable. And he has that accenting what's happening with the story.
The better comparison is a movie you've never seen, and we're going to do it in a few months, and it's called Nashville.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's also a musical of sorts, the Robert Altman version of a musical, where characters only sing, as I recall, when they're performing.
Mm-hmm.
And almost always on stage. Also a movie with some darkness, despite the lightness, despite the great songs that are in both films. And I do like the songs in this movie, some of them, not all of them. But it is hard to compare this film to the musicals on this list that have come before because of the Nazis' presence. Now, The Sound of Music, our last musical film, 1965, this is 72, 7 years difference, also dealt with Nazis, but more towards the end. And that one still found a way to be fluffy and light, even when they're being chased by these killers.
Yeah, talk about the anti-Sound of Music cabaret is different in every possible way, in the way it treats music, in its tone, in its performances, and even the non-Hollywoodness of it. It's just so messy. Almost, I wouldn't call it sloppy, because I feel like it's intentional.
Yeah.
The way it just kind of looks harried and put together and amateur, but that really goes with what they're trying to accomplish.
You think the whole film or the performances on stage in the cabaret?
The performances, definitely the production design, and that's definitely intentional.
But again, the whole film or just the scenes in the nightclub?
Well, the film doesn't look sloppy in that the lighting is good and the editing is phenomenal. It's a really, really well-cut film. They've got the canted angles, and it's kinetic and, like, all over the place. Frenetic would probably be the better word for that.
Yeah. Canted angles, you made me just think of something right here on the spot. German Expressionism in the silent film era.
They
were famous for that. Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, especially, where the camera would be tilted. And many movies, including The Third Man, some of the great ones, have paid tribute to that by doing the same thing.
And look at Joel Grey. Tell me he doesn't look like he belongs in the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. The makeup, the overkill, the makeup, the tuxedo, and his exaggerated expressions.
And the movie opens with a close-up of him in a ghastly silent film-type makeup.
Yes.
This really tight close-up on him is kind of scary, actually.
He plays the MC, by the way. We keep referring to him.
Yeah, he doesn't have an actual name. No. He's just the master of ceremonies.
Yeah.
He's not a guy that you've probably seen a lot of films, even if you are a big movie buff. This is only AFI film. He's in Kafka, which I saw not that long ago. It's on YouTube. Steven Soderbergh movie with Jeremy Irons. And a lot of TV, including an episode of Dallas, which I think was some kind of reunion special or a TV movie or something. And I won't give away what happens, but he's, in effect, J.R.'s conscience. He spent 50-plus years in the business. He won a Tony for this performance, in fact, as well as the Oscar. And he's Jennifer's dad, Jennifer Grey from Dirty Dancing.
I did not know that.
Thank you, Internet.
Wow. He will probably always bear the unfortunate distinction of being the, I would never call him unknown, but probably he's not a household name.
No, and I just told you why exactly. Yeah, he hasn't done much of anything of note since.
Yeah, most people wouldn't know who he is, but he is the guy who beat Al Pacino for the Oscar for the year he played Michael Corleone in The Godfather.
And that's the thing. I don't want to get too unfair here, ripping apart the Academy's decision to give him the Oscar. And it was probably one of those years where a bunch of actors from one movie split the vote because it was Pacino, and it was Robert Duvall, and it was James Caan. Any one of them would have been worthy. They must have split the vote. Pacino should have been the lead category. We're going to talk about this, all this on The Godfather very soon. But Grey got it instead. I do think it's horse pucky, because I don't think his performance really means anything. All of the musical performances, as good as they are, you might think they're better than I do. I acknowledge they're good. They exist in a vacuum, and I don't think they forward the story. I know they're counterpoint to what we see in the actual story, which is pretty effective. It's one of the musicals, and I've said this about other musicals, I think, too, where they don't advance the story, and it's almost like, I don't want to see you singing and dancing right now. Let's get back to the actual story.
I disagree with your estimation of his performance, that it's meaningless. I think he's
That's a little
probably
strong. Just not meaningful, not relevant, not critical.
Okay, I disagree with that. I think it is critical to the movie. I think he adds a tremendous amount to the movie. And maybe part of why you and I disagree about this film is that I just simply love singing and dancing. I could watch music videos all day long. I love this kind of
and
stuff.
And you've had to, because that's
and
your
then,
job.
Yeah, it has been my job for many years, and I've always liked that part of my job. Then maybe that gives me even a better appreciation for it. I've seen a lot of singing and dancing over the years, so it just delights me, and I probably appreciate the talent that he has. He has such an overwhelming seemingly incredible screen presence. I watched all these YouTube clips of him. He was on The Muppets. I watched his Oscar acceptance speech. And it's funny how much he really transforms. I know you could say it's about probably most actors, but I guess you expect him to just have this natural, sinister way about him. It's like when I started seeing Christoph Waltz do things as himself after I saw Inglourious Basterds. When somebody embodies that sinister menace so effectively, it's so strange watching them be just like a normal human.
Maybe even boring as compared to what they do in their big performances.
With his American accent, I was like, that's crazy. He was such an incredible performance. He's satirizing so much. And like you say, he feels like he's in that meaningful. He's not given a backstory. He doesn't even have a name, but in a way that's even better. He's this kind of presence, representative of all the people who turned and joked and laughed and turned away when the Nazis were coming to
He'd province. Be murdered in a second, unless they wanted to keep this cabaret going because they wanted a place to unwind. And we see Nazis at the very end, they're enjoying the show. But barring that, they would blow him away in a second because it seems like he's gay.
But he would get away. He would he would be the guy.
He'd be just trailing behind the Von Trapps.
In the exactly. He would just put on a suit, wash his face, tousle his hair, and blend in with the crowd and laugh while he's getting away without feeling remotely bad that he left all his girls behind. I kept thinking, because we just saw Clockwork, I'm like, they're his droogs. They're like his little sinister friends that follow him around. And
he has one key moment in the movie, and I think it's very important to now segue into the star of this movie. We haven't even talked about it yet.
I know.
But here's the moment I'll give you that this performance is very good. Maybe from a writing standpoint, there's no dialogue, and it's only for about a second. We see Joel Grey and Liza Minnelli behind the curtain of the cabaret, and no one's watching this, and he reaches up and he feels her boobs from behind. And that 1 or 2 seconds of film suggests to me, is that a quid pro quo relationship? Is she banging him to get what she wants, to be the star of this nightclub?
Yeah.
Because we know she's loose. She's admitted it many times. In fact, this is the rare promiscuous woman on the AFI Top 100. Yeah.
She tells a story about how she slept with a producer just so that she could get parts.
And maybe the MC doesn't have that kind of power, but that 1-2 seconds of film maybe says everything about what he's really doing in the end.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, Liza Minnelli, let's talk about the star of the whole thing. Very talented person. This is someone who probably benefited from nepotism because of her last name and her mother. But Liza was good. I've never been a huge fan of hers. She's obviously a gay icon. I think most people think about Judy Garland and Liza Minnelli certainly fit that bill. This is her only AFI film. She didn't make a lot of movies, period. She was in New York, a couple years later, that Scorsese directed with Robert De Niro. She was in Arthur with Dudley Moore, which is a pretty fun comedy. And the thing I've liked her best in, and maybe you agree, would be Arrested Development.
Oh, yeah. It's Lucille, too.
That's right. She's very funny in that, actually. But her credits are really kind of over after that. There's other ones, but nothing really all that major. But she was only 25 when they shot this movie, and she did win the Best Actress Oscar, which is rare to win an Oscar that young, and has only been in a few movies total in the past 25 years.
I didn't realize her career was that sparse, because she just feels like she's such a presence.
The irony of Sally, from Liza's point of view, is that the Sally character wants to be a great film star, and Liza Minnelli probably felt the same way, and soon you could argue she was a great film star. But booze and sex are a problem for Sally. I guess it's more drugs than booze. I don't know about sex so much. We're a problem for Liza. So it was life later imitating the art.
I didn't realize that she had drug problems, Liza Minnelli.
Do you remember that episode of The Simpsons? They go to New York and they're watching that show Checking In?
Yes.
Well, in that, Lisa says something like, they're strapping down Liza Minnelli.
Oh, I didn't realize that. I didn't know that much about her aside from she was Judy Garland and Vincent Minnelli's daughter, a couple of her very iconic roles, and that she's a gay icon. I never loved her. I find her off-putting. There's something about her that just kind of rubs me the wrong way and I find a little annoying. I think she's wonderful as Sally Bowles. I mean, Sally Bowles, the character, is a little bit annoying. She's like this manic pixie dream girl, but then shows us all the pitfalls of being a manic pixie dream girl. She's trying so hard to be that type of person, but it's a persona. It's all performative.
Yeah.
And then she becomes so much more interesting and alluring once the cracks start to appear in that veneer.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
You know, we catch her repeating the same effusive praise. I love that moment when we meet Fritz and she says, he's simply my oldest friend in Berlin and he follows me around everywhere. And then an hour later, she's at the party at Maximilian's house. And we hear her giving almost word for word the exact same speech. And I think she's talking about Brian. I can't remember. But she's saying the exact same words, and you can see her doing the exact same performance that she did for Brian when she first met him. And there's this desperation to her that's always under the surface. She plays it so well. That vulnerability comes through, and it's her appeal, but it's also her undoing. Everybody talks about how the moment that probably won her the Oscar is when she sings that title number at the end, and it's just so painfully ironic. She's shouting out, she's throwing her arms. She's saying, life is a cabaret. And, you know, she's just trying to convince herself. She's not convincing anybody, least of all herself. And that song, when you listen to it, is a painfully sad song. She sings about her friend Elsie and Chelsea, who OD'd, and she's made such a beautiful corpse. And you know when she's singing it so earnestly that she's going to get her wish. She's going to make a beautiful corpse. It's a really tragic ending.
It almost doesn't matter about the Nazis in that one standpoint. Maybe they'll kill her, but they don't need to. She's going to kill herself.
Yeah.
She's always performing, including the fact that she wears gaudy stage makeup, even at home.
This is the second movie in a row, by the way, where there was probably a fake eyelash wrangler in the credits. Yeah. But she even sleeps in her fake eyelashes at one point.
Both very iconic looks, too, because Malcolm McDowell in The Clockwork Orange has that one in the poster shot. And she wears hers regularly.
There's a few times she doesn't, I guess just enough times so that as an audience, we know that they're not trying to fool us into believing those are her real eyelashes.
Just like she has the fake mole under the left eye.
Yeah, that's right.
I said she's the rare promiscuous lady on the AFI's Top 100. Brian, who is Michael York, is the rare sexually ambiguous AFI character because he's bisexual. It's not exactly subtle. And then at the end, when he leaves, he bails, he's gotten her pregnant, or someone has. We think it could be his baby, it could be Maximilian's baby, we're not really sure.
Could be the MC's baby.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, that moment is more and more important the more I think about that.
I love that touch. I wonder if they debated leaving it in, but it's...
You know what it reminded me of? I saw this movie again a few months ago, Sherry Baby. Maggie Gyllenhaal's in that.
Okay.
And I think it's Timothy Bottoms, who was in the Last Picture Show.
Really?
Who plays her father. Now, if you've never seen Sherry Baby, turn away for about 10 seconds. He's trying to comfort her, and he reaches up and he feels her up. And it isn't subtle. Is this suggesting that this woman is broken because she was molested? But I wonder if that maybe is why this is hitting me the way it is. It's almost like, well, there you go. You're telling an entire separate movie's worth in a matter of seconds in both films. But anyway, so Michael York, his only AFI film. He was in Murder on the Orient Express with a whole lot of other co-stars a couple years after this. Logan's Run, one of his more famous roles. And then Austin Powers, because he plays... What character in the Austin Powers series? What's his name?
Oh, come on. I don't know.
Basil Exposition. Now, he's had a long career, 50 years as well for him, just like Joel Grey. A lot of other guys screen tested for Brian. Malcolm McDowell, not long after doing Clockwork Orange. Timothy Dalton, who later played Bond, and Jeremy Irons. But they gave it to York, and he's got this ordinary sort of look about him. And he looks like he could have been one of the German characters very easily. He's got he's blonde...
Germanic looking.
Yeah, that Germanic look to him. He doesn't go over the top with the fey thing, but he isn't exactly masculine either.
He's very good at being ambiguous. And in that moment when she first hits on him and he turns her down... You kind of buy that he doesn't really even know what it is and why he's never connected with a woman.
Do you think he loves her? And when he pledges to be the father of this baby, whether it's his or not, when they're both drunk, do you think he truly means that? Because he does bail at the end after he found out she had the abortion.
Well, yeah, he's optimistic and he's infatuated, but I believe Brian Roberts is a stand-up guy.
Okay.
He would foster that infatuation into love. If he made that commitment, the easier answer would be yes, I believe that he was in love with her.
But he's a gay man who's kind of flirting with being straight in this one instance.
I don't know, I think he's bisexual.
And two failed instances, as he talks about earlier.
Three.
Three in total.
No, he says there were three failed. They were the wrong three girls.
That's right.
There were three before her.
Had to find
but
Sally.
I disagree that he is gay. I think he's bisexual. He's into it. He's into the sex with her.
So all of these things we've been talking about the last few minutes about her, about him, about the storyline itself, Republicans would hate this movie because it's filled with homosexuality, abortion, promiscuity, and they're entertainers. Awful, awful stuff.
And they're foreigners.
Well, she's not, but the rest of them are, yeah.
No, but they're in a foreign country. Well, okay, fine. They're foreigners in a country other than America.
The other major subplot in the movie would be the relationship between Natalia, Marissa Berenson, and Fritz. These two actors are people that most people have never heard of. Marissa Berenson is Natalia. Fritz Wepper is Fritz. He mostly did German movies, and he's still making them even now. This is the only Berenson AFI film. She was in Barry Lyndon. We've mentioned that so much lately because of all the Kubrick films and all the actors and technicians he used. She's still working, and she's close friends with Liza Minnelli. I guess they met in this film, and they stayed friends for all these years later now. The other major actor in the film, and he's actually probably the third lead, even ahead of Joel Grey, is Helmut Grimm, I guess how you say his name? Grimm. He's also a German, and he is the Jay Gatsby of this movie because he is Max. And then he just disappears, but he's the rich friend. But getting back to Fritz and Natalia, the movie is disturbingly dated in one key way because of the whole thing with her rape, from the no, to the yes, 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 my yes. She basically says those words I just used when Fritz comes on to her.
They call it pouncing in this movie. He pounced on her. And I'm not saying I'm comfortable with it. It's just another one of those things we have to forgive because it was a movie made in the 70s. It would never happen now. Nobody would ever include a detail like that. Or they would just word it differently. Instead of making it sound so much like a rape, maybe just more aggressively seductive would be less menacing than what they describe, because no means yes.
Most scenes that they have are not with each other. They're interacting with Sally and Brian. We see them together and she's standoffish. Beautiful woman. Not surprisingly, she would be standoffish with this kind of nerdy fellow. Then she talks about how he did this stuff to her. And then later on, she talks about being in love with him. So they do have an arc, even though they're really not on screen together that much. He does win her back later. They have a scene together then.
Yeah, ambiguous rape aside, I really could have done without that side plot. Mm-hmm. I wish they could have found some other way to have a Jewish character incorporate the real menace of the Nazis with a character that we cared about in some other way rather than having this whole elaborate love story between Fritz and Natalia.
Unless I'm missing something, the two worst things the Nazis do in this movie are one, that they kill a dog, and the other one is that they sing a song. Let's do the dog part first.
They beat up the club manager as well.
Oh, right. Okay, but let's get to the two I mentioned because I forgot about that one.
Okay.
So I like the editing. You mentioned the editing before. It's a great example of this. We see them writing Juden, or it is?
I don't know, yeah. I guess
which means, it means Jew.
Okay.
Because that's in Saving Private Ryan, an AFI movie we'll cover towards the end of the project. Adam Goldberg in that film, a whole line of Nazis are going by him, and he's just looking at himself and pointing at him, Juden, mocking them, essentially. Yeah. What are they going to do? They're captured. But anyway, we see that painted on the ground, and then we see Natalia open her door, and she's shocked. We think, oh, it says Juden on her front step. But no, it's her dog that's been murdered.
And all that is intercut with a dancing scene at the club, which is Joel Grey and the girls. And it's the one where he's in drag, and they're just dancing and being ever so silly. And then their hats turn around and turn into helmets.
Mm-hmm.
And they start marching in this ridiculous satire of Nazis. The last thing you see is the dead dog. And then Joel Grey takes his wig off with the helmet. And he's carrying around on a cane like a severed head. He's pulled his shirt off and he's topless and he's laughing maniacally. It is an incredibly sinister part of the movie. One of my favorite examples of his performance and how potent it is in this film.
And great cross-cutting, too.
Great cross-cutting. I have had, I think, three separate teachers when I was in college show me scenes from this movie as examples for editing. It's a phenomenally cut film. Maybe could have been a shade shorter, but the way they cross-cut between scenes, and they do this many times. There's that example that we just named. There's another one with Maybe This Time, which is Liza Minnelli singing this beautiful, heartbreaking song about how every man leaves her because she's a loser, but maybe this one is different, and that's cross-cut with this really cutesy infatuation between her and Brian as they're glancing at each other over their newspapers and lying in bed and cracking jokes with each other and having ever so much fun. And there's a couple of other examples throughout the film of moving back and forth between stories and music, and the scenes are so tight and short.
But see, I don't think they needed all that. I think the drama part of this, I know it's a musical, so of course you got to have music based on a stage play. I don't think we said that yet. Very successful one. Kander and Ebb, very famous names in the musical game. But I don't think it needed all that. Their relationship alone with the Nazis' presence in the background, even if we want to have their friends in there as a subplot. Woody Allen does that all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody makes romantic comedies does that. And this isn't really a comedy, it's a romantic drama. But I don't think it needed the cross-cutting. We get the gist. We get the point.
But that's because you don't like musicals.
When they're done right, I love Singing in the Rain, I love
that's
Wizard
true,
of Oz.
You do. Yeah, you
and
do.
I respected elements. I even respected elements of this one. I liked it a hell of a lot more. I wouldn't have said Cabba Blank and Ray when I watched the show if I had seen this again fresh. Although I don't think it's one of the greatest movies of all time. The other thing I talked about that's an absolute Nazi presence, apart from the very end where we see them, I think that's the last shot of the movie, is this out-of-focus type thing where they're in the crowd. But it would be when the youth are singing a song, Tomorrow Belongs to Me.
Yes.
Whoa.
Yeah, with great passion and fervor and commitment. They are singing this patriotic song about
world domination.
Future. Yeah, about world domination. It's a foreboding, prophetic moment that's trying to illustrate things are getting worse in Berlin. And Sally is almost aggressively ignoring it and pretending it's not happening.
What are entertainers supposed to do? They're not going to pick up a gun and fight. Or if they are, they're just part of the military. What are they supposed to do? She's just trying to make a living. And she doesn't seem like somebody who's all that interested in anything other than her own personal life anyway. She is a little bit insular. She is a little bit selfish. Christopher Isherwood, who wrote some kind of short story this is based on, I was reading about this, so I forget the details. He said that she's miscast. Not that he'd had a problem with her. She's remarkably talented. But Sally's not supposed to be very talented.
Yeah, in the play, she's not as
she's a wannabe.
Yeah.
So the whole, I want to be a great film star thing, so you're not going to be.
Yeah.
But the way Liza Minnelli actually plays it, because she doesn't sing badly. No, she doesn't really fit that description. And that's okay. I'm not criticizing her or the movie for that. But she's not the loser that maybe she's supposed to be, according to the original story. But she doesn't really care about the politics of it. And a lot of entertainers
don't. She's not even German, so it's true. Why should she care? And, like, most people, period, don't care about politics.
Not enough. We've seen the real progression of that in the last 30 years or so. Not to say that actors and entertainers, rock stars, whatnot, haven't been political for a very long time. In our lifetimes, in our adulthood anyway, they've been on the front lines for a lot of things. Clooney especially, Sean Penn, Susan Sarandon.
You talk about how John Wayne was a Republican.
Yeah. Outspoken, yeah. About
yeah, there were outspoken.
Well, it's always happened, for sure.
Yeah.
And then the March on Washington, people like Marlon Brando and Charlton Heston, Paul Newman, white people were all part of that.
Yeah.
You know, it had nothing to do with them directly. It was about the African-American struggle.
So I don't know if it's new to our generation.
Maybe it's just more publicized, like everything else is more publicized.
Yeah, they have a louder voice.
But Sally would not have been on the March on Washington or any of these other things.
No.
All right, we've been talking about how this is a World War II, or at least a pre-World War II film. Our next movie, The Godfather, is a just-after-World War II film. And this movie also begins a string of five straight period films, many decades before. Not only period, but a long time before. Last Picture Show was only about 20 years before it was made, but this is a good 40 years before that. It is set in Berlin in 1931, and it was actually shot in Berlin and Munich and all those other places around that area, so in Germany. That would have been during the Berlin Wall era. It was 17 years later when the thing came down. So we're still talking about Cold War filmmaking here, too. It'd be easier to make this movie, a lot easier to make most of this movie, at least, in America, but they didn't do that. Some of the scenes are actually set on location, so you would have had to find something that looked at least somewhat German.
You can find plenty of parts of Europe that could pass for Berlin, though, I'm sure.
One of my favorite moments in the whole film is when Sally sings to an empty nightclub.
Oh, yeah.
Because every entertainer knows that feeling. Every comedian, stand-up comic, every actor, every sports star who's ever wanted to be Wayne Gretzky's played in front of nobody. I'm sure you've been in that situation being a stand-up comic many years before. And, of course, the director of that and every other sequence in this film is Bob Fosse.
Oh, right. He was a performer.
Mm-hmm. So he knows that feeling. He was actually
the choreographer for a long time before he did this film.
His only AFI film. He only did five films in total. This is the second one he ever did. He did Lenny a couple years after this. Dustin Hoffman plays Lenny Bruce. And then All That Jazz with Roy Scheider. Billy Wilder and Gene Kelly had the chance to direct it and turned it down. Wilder wasn't really a musical director. Of course, Gene Kelly was.
Yeah.
Maybe Gene Kelly didn't like the dark material in that because he did all those light and fluffy type musicals.
Yeah, it just wasn't his style. Fosse had to fight for the project.
I know what it was. Gene Kelly was still mad about the Malcolm McDowell thing when he saw him on a party. You made a mockery of Singing in the Rain, you dick. But Fosse, we didn't even mention his name until right now. The director of the film, he won the Oscar.
Yeah, over
Francis Ford Coppola.
Yeah.
And even that matter, John Borman, Deliverance.
Oh, man.
Which I like better than this film, for sure. And I think should have made the list, to
what
be honest.
What a great year, 72, was it?
Mm-hmm. There were other good films, but those three are probably the top three. Deliverance probably wasn't that close to winning any Oscars. But then again, it was up against Godfather and Cabaret.
Yeah, it just had tough competition.
Fosse's direction was excellent, and I have no issue with him winning the Oscar. He probably did deserve it. I do prefer Lenny and All That Jazz. We own Lenny, actually. We should put
I've
on
never
our
seen it.
List of movies, one of the many we have definitely to watch. The writer J. Preston Allen did Marnie, Prime of Miss Jean Brody, and he was uncredited on The Verdict. And he did based on the 1966 Candor and Ebb musical. Ralph Burns as well as a name. These names don't mean much to me. I don't know much about Candor and Ebb, but I do know they're famous. I'll say that much. I know they're famous musical composers, much like Rodgers and Hammerstein and many other people. And the producer, Cy Feuer.
I know, his name rhymes with mein Feuer.
He only produced a few films, including A Chorus Line, which was the mid-80s. He was a composer back in the 30s and for many years after that.
Wow.
And got into producing later on.
I totally want to give a shout out to the production design team, which was made up of, and bear with me here, Rolf Zehetbauer, Hans-Jürgen Kiebach, and Herbert Strabel. One of my favorite elements of the film is how they created this whole world that looks like it was put together by amateurs, but is clearly intentionally a little too much. The costumes have their seams showing and they're all a little bit ill-fitting. We already talked about the makeup, which is just towing that line with being grotesque, especially
I think it passes
on Joel
Grey.
Okay, especially on Joel Grey, and almost on the dancers, and not really so much on Sally. Contrast that with the beautiful mansions, the boarding house, which is clearly one of those old dilapidated mansions. And we're talking about 1930s Berlin, so this was a Germany in trouble and all these old wealthy homes being turned into boarding houses, contrasted with Maximilian's house. I love what they did with the costumes, with the sets. This film really did that right.
And this isn't costumes and it isn't sets, but there's a line from Liza Minnelli that she says makes her be the star of this show even more so. She's the only woman on the stage with shaved armpits. I didn't notice that, but I read that on the internet.
I did not notice that. Hey, did you notice how she wears a lot of the clothes twice? You don't see this in very many movies.
Good point.
And she's a fashionista.
TV, you don't even see that.
No, I know.
The characters on Friends.
They never were
not
the same
to rip into
twice.
Friends, but that's one of those shows. Is a great example of people who live way beyond their means, or what their means could ever possibly be with the jobs they all have
in New York City.
Yeah, the mansion that they live in, apartment wise at least, and they never wear the same clothes twice either. Even though people like us, we're not poor. I don't have a great wardrobe. Of course, I do wear things over and over again.
It's funny how
for those listening to this podcast, breaking news: people wear clothes more than once.
It's funny how a little detail like that just lends so much authenticity to a film that's about artifice.
Most movies either have people never wearing the same outfit twice, or they only wear one outfit in the whole movie, because they're on the run for an hour and a half, and that's the whole story. Okay, technically, behind the scenes, 1:85:1 ratio film Technicolor. We've done a lot of color lately, and we continue to do that. We saw a download that often looked like pixelated bratwurst. It was pretty terrible. This is the second to last movie that we don't actually own. We don't have Tootsie either, but I think I can borrow that from a friend. But yeah, it did look pretty terrible. I don't want to criticize the DVD or Blu-ray because we didn't actually see that version, but it did look pretty ratty. The cinematographer shooting it, though, and what we could see that looked fine, it was only moments where it was badly pixelated, actually. Jeffrey Unsworth did a pretty good job, we hope, we think.
It's really just the beginning that was bad, and then it cleaned up. Come now. We didn't watch, like, a YouTube clip of Cabaret.
Not like our very first film, Birth of a Nation, which was on YouTube.
Yeah, that's the only film we ended up watching on YouTube.
But even aside with YouTube, sometimes you can find great-looking prints on there.
Absolutely.
If it sets this criterion, if you see the very beginning of it and you see the little C in the corner, stick with it. Some of the Bergman films are on there, and they look like your DVD, what are almost, at least. Mm-hmm. Awfully close to it. So Jeffrey Unsworth did shoot it. He also did 2001, an AFI film, along with Beckett before it, and then the two Superman films for Richard Donner, Superman 1 and Superman 2. The editing. Bev's going to want to comment on this. David Bretherton did Diary of Anne Frank, Silver Streak, and Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. What a great resume that is. Talk about diversity.
I said everything I want to say about the editing. It's fantastic. If people wanted an example from me of what a great edited film is, this would be the
Except
top
you've criticized movies for being too long and not being very well paced. Maybe it's well paced, but it does not need to be 2 hours. And forget the subplot we criticized. It doesn't need to be 2 hours
anyway.
The
only thing, I would take out the subplot and that's it. Or I would shorten the subplot or maybe even on a script level, but I didn't think it felt long. I just didn't.
Okay.
I'm just entertained by the singing and dancing more. The way those dance sequences were edited, intentionally chaotic and very fast-paced, especially for the time, which you can probably credit as an influence to a lot of music videos.
Yes, for
from
sure.
From then on.
And
definitely,
if they're thrown together, if that's the quality, if that's the vibe they're giving off, they should be, because these people aren't talented enough to do anything truly professional.
Yeah.
That's the point.
It's supposed to have that amateur feel.
Yeah. Well, the composer, John Kander, did Funny Lady, Chicago. That was turned into a movie that won the Oscar many years after this. And the uncredited work by Ralph Burns. That leads us into influence, and one of them would definitely be Moulin Rouge in Chicago. Moulin Rouge was nominated for Best Picture, and Chicago won Best Picture.
Yeah, this movie made me want to watch Chicago again. I've been thinking about it ever since.
I've always liked Chicago. A lot of people criticize it for winning the Oscar that year, and it shouldn't have. I agree with that part of it. But just on the level of being a good movie, it is.
Yeah, very entertaining.
And it's also
film.
Pretty cynical and dark. Renee Zellweger's character is one of those, much like a De Niro character, who doesn't learn anything. She's a horrible human being, but very well played. Can she sing great? No. She's actually what Sally Bowles is supposed to be.
Yeah.
She may have been a better Sally Bowles if she'd been around in 1972. Also, the movie is influenced by Casablanca. Because there's a Dune romance, a love triangle, Nazis, and nightclubs.
Oh, you're right.
There was a TV movie in 1993, Jane Horrocks and Alan Cumming. You can guess who played which part. Directed by Sam Mendes before he was a film director on American Beauty.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Other influence for me, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, both the movie and certainly the Broadway show, which we saw earlier this year.
Yeah, and we loved it, by the way.
What we could see of it because we were in bad seats.
Obstructive view.
I haven't given many trivia questions in this entire podcast. I didn't have a lot to actually to give. But one of them is pretty well known by anybody who follows the Oscars really closely. And what is it that this film is relevant for when it comes to Oscar wins?
Oh, I think it holds the distinction of winning Best Picture while winning the fewest Oscars overall.
No, you got that backwards. It won the most Oscars that didn't win Best Picture.
Because Godfather won Best Picture.
That's right.
Right. That's what I meant.
It won 8, but didn't win Best Picture. Best Director for Fosse, Best Actress for Minnelli, Best Supporting Actor for Gray, the editing by Bretherton, Unsworth's cinematography, those sets you just talked about, the sound design, and that Kander, Nebb, and Ralph Burns music. It was also nominated for Best Picture, of course, and the screenplay. Cabaret made the National Film Registry in 1995, and then it was on two other AFI lists. The title song was 18th in the top 100 songs, and it was 5th in the top 25 musicals. I remember being surprised by that when I saw it, but okay. You think it's the second best musical we've seen, which makes it the second best musical the AFI ever did, because this is our last one.
Yeah.
The other nomination it got was Tomorrow Belongs to Me in the top 100 songs. And kind of
really?
Thank God
that
it didn't.
Song? I would have picked Mine Hair for sure. I love that one.
Yeah, the songs in the nightclub are probably better, but maybe the idea being that it's this whole tone. And it's definitely different for any musical to have a song like that.
Oh, yeah.
That is clearly meant to horrify all of us. People in the crowd listening to it on the set, in the storyline, and then us as an audience member.
Yeah.
Before we end here, I don't know much of anything about the stage play, the musical. Do you know anything about it at all? Did you ever see it?
I have seen it on stage because my high school performed it when I was in, this is for Ontario folks, grade 13. My high school put it on. I didn't take part in the production at all. It wasn't as racy as the movie, but I looked it up in my research, and it was very different from the play. Yeah. They made a lot of significant changes. They switched out songs. The characters of Fritz and Natalia were new to the movie. We already talked about how Sally's character was different, apparently. Brian's character was different. They never even had sex in the play. He was always sexually ambiguous. It wasn't suggested he was gay. It was just that he wasn't interested. He was kind of a eunuch. A significant departure from the play.
You know, it's interesting. We talk about how movies so often have their testicles cut off, we'll put it that way, by the modern rating system. And the rating system existed in 1972 as well. But if they made a movie today of this and had the courage to go this route, they would have her be a flat-out whore. Because she's obviously willing to whore herself out. I'm not criticizing Sally Boy's character.
You mean like a prostitute who takes money for it as opposed to jobs?
I said quid pro quo earlier with an MC. And
yeah, but I thought you meant he got her the gig and so she put out an exchange.
Yeah, so it's not money, but it's a job that leads to money. I've said this before, and not on the podcast probably, but it's in life. We're all prostitutes in a way if you're selling your body. How is an athlete not a prostitute? He's selling his body. He's not having something enter his body, but he's still a prostitute of a sort.
I don't think Sally Bowles would even balk at the distinction. I think that if somebody called her a whore, she'd be like, sure, it floats my boat. Just, I don't care if you're judging me. Like,
just surviving, baby.
Yeah, I just talked about Mine Her. That whole song is a testament of Valentine to promiscuity. She's not ashamed of the way that she is and the way that she lives.
And Brian gets away before the story is over. Goes back to London, I guess. He leaves Germany, at least. Mm-hmm. But she and the MC, I'll say it again, are probably not long for this world. Unless
The MC will get away.
Okay, you have faith in that. Put it this way. Their types are not long for this world. Unless the Nazis say, you know what, leave this one. We'll have that at night. We can have fun in there. But otherwise, they would just gun these people down because they are not what Mein Führer would approve of.
Well, she's an American, so that would probably do
another reason
right there, yeah.
All right, well, that's it for Cabaret. We're away next week, so the Top 100 Project will be taking a rare break. When we return on January 26th, we've got a honey of a doozy. It's Brando, Pacino, Caan, Duvall, Keaton, and an army of talented co-stars in Francis Ford Coppola's mob classic, The Godfather. All right, the coming attractions trivia for The Godfather. It was surpassed by only 4 movies from the entire decade of the 1970s on the Box Office Mojo adjusted for inflation list. We haven't talked about that so much lately. We haven't had any giant hits like that. But of course, as we know, that's actual tickets sold. 2 of those movies are AFI films, 2 are not. What are those 4 flicks?
Well, I know what one of them is. There's one really easy movie on that list. But if you'd like the answer to that question, please tune in 2 weeks from now to our Godfather podcast. If you'd like more trivia, along with lots of other fun stuff from Ryan and me, including links to some of the things we've talked about today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes, and you can also find us at Podomatic, top100project.podomatic.com. What do you think of Cabaret? We would love to hear what you think. Please send us a message. Our email address is top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Mein Führer, I can dance with jazz hands, jazz hands, jazz hands.
And cut.